The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles initially from the Harvard Heart Letter, and then from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. First, from the Harvard Heart Letter of July 2024 is an article called Meditation, a Heartfelt Habit. Meditation may lower blood pressure and help people make healthier choices when coping with stress. Meditating sounds so simple. Just sit comfortably and quiet your mind. Yet even seasoned practitioners will tell you that settling into a meditative state isn't easy, especially when you're anxious, worried, or stressed. But meditation may benefit people prone to cardiovascular disease, so it's worth giving this mind-calming technique a try. When you start any new activity, coaching or guidance can really help, and that's also true when learning to meditate, says Dr. Darshan Mehta, medical director of the Benson Henry Institute for Mind-Body Medicine at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. Many communities have meditation centers where you can take classes in person, but online courses, which are much more convenient and accessible, can be just as effective. Another option is to try a smartphone app that offers guided meditation. Popular ones include Headspace, Calm, Insight Timer, and 10% Happier. Meditation practices fall into two broad categories: focused attention and open monitoring. With focused attention, you concentrate on one thing, counting, a mantra, a word or phrase like peace or may I be well, or an object, a candle, a tree, prayer beads. One well-known form, transcendental meditation, uses mantras. With open monitoring, you open your awareness to everything you're experiencing, including thoughts, feelings, sounds, and bodily sensations. Mindfulness meditation, which has become popular in recent decades, incorporates both attention and awareness. Other forms of meditation include samatha, which is calming and concentration, vipassana, which is insight, and metta, M-E-T-T-A, loving kindness meditation. Here are some tips to foster a regular meditation practice. Practice when it's practical. For some people, mornings are most convenient. Others prefer to meditate at the end of the day. Stick with it. Make it a habit once you've found your ideal time of day to meditate. Don't have high expectations. You won't emerge from your first session as a changed human being. Meditation is a process. You will see improvements gradually. Meditate wherever you can find quiet moments alone, in your bedroom, at work, or while walking in the park. To focus your mind, use something meaningful to you, like a candle, a piece of art, or a photo of a loved one. Be prepared to be uncomfortable. Stilling your thoughts is harder than it sounds. It could take a while for you to feel comfortable in the practice. Don't fight the feeling. Relax into the practice. Let your thoughts drift away. Ease into your breath. Even if you feel slightly uncomfortable, try to give in to the feeling and not push back against it. And be kind to yourself. If you don't get the hang of meditation right away, forgive yourself and try again. You will eventually get it. After each session, pause and take stock of your feelings. Have you let go of any tension or anxiety? If not, do you need to relax for a few minutes more? Now, there's also a brief article that's entitled How Meditation May Help Your Heart. An article published in February 2024 looked at the potential cardiovascular benefits from two types of meditation: mindfulness-based practices and transcendental meditation. The authors analyzed 81 randomized controlled trials involving a total of 7,000 people. Overall, the findings were mixed, which may reflect some of the inherent challenges of studying meditation. For one thing, creating an appropriate placebo or control group for meditation is tricky. Often the controls are either people on a waiting list to receive meditation training, or those who do crossword puzzles or attend education sessions. For another, the people most likely to volunteer for a meditation study are often already sold on meditation's benefits and may differ from those who aren't interested in the practice. The review found that mindfulness-based interventions probably reduce stress and may also lower anxiety, depression, and blood pressure. Transcendental meditation may also reduce blood pressure. According to the authors, some of meditation's effects may be indirect. When people feel calmer, that may help them to avoid unhealthy ways of coping with stress, like drinking alcohol or making poor food choices. Now here's another article from the Harvard Heart Letter, and it's entitled Update on Atrial Fibrillation. New guidelines focus on lifestyle habits to prevent and control this common heart rhythm disorder. Atrial fibrillation causes a rapid, chaotic heartbeat that usually comes and goes without warning. Commonly known as AFib, it's caused by electrical misfires in the heart's upper chambers. While some people don't notice any symptoms, others feel a fluttering, pounding sensation in their chest and may become lightheaded, dizzy, and breathless during a bout of atrial fib. But the real danger is a heightened risk of serious strokes. An estimated 1 in 11 people aged 65 and older have atrial fib, which becomes more common with age. There are many things you can do to both lower your risk and prevent the progression of AFib, says Dr. Musa Mansour, a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and director of the atrial fibrillation program at Massachusetts General Hospital. In fact, lifestyle modifications are now a prominent focus of the latest guidelines for managing AFib. Here's a summary of the updated recommendations that were published in the January 2024 issue of the journal Circulation. The most important advice is about alcohol, which is one of the first things my patients act about, says Dr. Mansour. Strong evidence from multiple studies shows that drinking alcohol raises the risk of AFib. There's no magic number of drinks considered safe or risky, although the guidelines suggest no more than one per day. But it's clear the less alcohol you drink, the better, he says. In some people, caffeine seems to trigger palpitations, the sensation of a skipped, missed, or strong heartbeat. But observational studies haven't shown any increased risk of atrial fib among coffee drinkers. In fact, one found that people who drink 1 to 3 cups of coffee daily are less likely to have AFib than people who drink lower or higher amounts. Caffeine doesn't seem to be something people need to worry about, says Dr. Musa. Excess weight, on the other hand, is an issue for many people. Obesity, which is defined as a body mass index of 30 or higher, promotes AFib on several fronts. First, it can worsen high blood pressure. And second, it makes people more prone to obstructive sleep apnea. In addition, clinical studies show that obesity increases fat around the heart. This promotes inflammation of the heart muscle, which may lead to changes in the structure of the atria, spurring the onset and progression of atrial fib, he adds. The guidelines recommend that people strive for a BMI of 27 or lower. Research suggests that even modest weight loss can help keep your heart rhythm more stable and is linked to better outcomes following treatment for AFib. Exercise not only supports weight loss, but can lower AFib burden, which refers to both the duration and frequency of AFib. The AFib guidelines suggest 210 minutes of moderate to vigorous intensity physical activity per week, which may also help reduce AFib symptoms. But Dr. Mansour keeps the advice to his patients simple. Aim for 3 to 4 hours of exercise every week. at a level of effort that's more than a casual walk, but nothing too crazy. Dedicated exercise buffs who work out far more than the average person can still develop AFib. If you train for marathons in your 30s and keep up that level of intensity in your 60s, the recommendation is to do less exercise if you develop AFib, says Dr. Mansour. But if exercise is a big deal for you and important for your mental health, there's no hard and fast rule about dialing back, he says. Dr. Mansour also recommends that anyone with AFib who snores should be tested for sleep apnea, a condition marked by brief pauses in breathing that often trigger loud snoring, grunts, or gasps. More than 1 in 5 people with AFib have sleep apnea, and treating the problem may lessen AFib recurrence. Now we're going to turn to the Mayo Clinic Health Letter and an article called Facial Skin Care. Cosmetic treatments can smooth wrinkles without surgery. Wrinkles can be a sign of a life well lived. They might deepen each time you smile, laugh at a joke, or squint to read. While there's nothing unhealthy about wrinkles, treatments are available to help fill them in, smooth them out, and make them less visible. Wrinkles appear in areas that get a lot of sun, like the backs of your hands and your face. As skin ages, it loses elasticity, so it doesn't spring back into place like a baby's smooth skin does. Genetics, sunlight, smoking, and exposure to pollutants all contribute to signs of aging on the skin. A good skincare routine can help protect your skin and prevent wrinkles. The 5 steps to do daily are: wash your skin with a mild cleanser, use a physical or chemical exfoliant to rid your skin or debris and dead skin cells. If you have sensitive skins, do this step only a few times a week. Apply a skin toner, a water-based lotion or tonic to clean and tighten your pores. Moisturize and hydrate your skin to temporarily fill in little creases. And apply sun protection to expose areas like your face and neck. It points out that some moisturizers already contain sunscreen. Even sun that shines through windows can age skin. So use sun protection every day, all year round. It's ideal to use a physical sunscreen, such as one containing zinc oxide or titanium dioxide. This creates a physical barrier against UV rays. A tinted sunscreen can be nice because it's like a light layer of makeup on the skin. Here are more steps for a fresher-looking skin without surgery. At-home topical creams. Moisturizers and creams are the first step in reducing wrinkles. You can get products with retinol, antioxidants, and peptides at drugstores or anywhere you buy cosmetics. Retinol and retinoids are forms of vitamin A. They are cornerstones of wrinkle products. Retinoids are available by prescription only. With consistent use, products that contain retinols or retinoids can reduce signs of aging. The products are rubbed into the skin to reduce fine wrinkles, splotches, and roughness. But these products also can make the skin more sensitive. You may notice redness and dryness when you first start using retinol or retinoid. It takes the skin about 4 to 6 weeks to adapt, so that those side effects are no longer visible, says Lila Talemat, a dermatologist at Mayo Clinic in Florida. Peeling is proof that the cream is helping the skin exfoliate properly. With continued use, better color and luster will likely emerge in a few weeks. Ramp up product use gradually if you get skin irritation. Start using it every third night, then every other night, and finally every night. Unless your dermatologist suggests otherwise, use retinol products at night because they can be inactivated by sunlight. The sun tends to burn skin treated with these products more easily, though that can be countered by using a sunscreen. Skincare products available without a prescription are classified as cosmetics, so they aren't regulated the same way that drugs are. That could mean that your product contains only a little bit of the active ingredient. Expensive products don't necessarily work better than less expensive products. Non-surgical wrinkle treatments are done by licensed professionals. Wrinkle treatments come with some risk, including swelling, redness, and irritation. A dermatologist or licensed aesthetician can help you choose the product that's best for you and assess your skin's health at the same time. People who are pregnant or have a weakened immune system should first talk to their healthcare team or avoid these procedures. There's a big advantage to seeking this type of care from medical professionals, as they can do the peel or injection and also are able to assess the skin in general. If there is something there that is worrisome and needs a biopsy, there is an advantage to having someone skilled in medicine taking care of those things. Here are some non-surgical skin procedures to consider. And the first is laser resurfacing. There are two common approaches to laser resurfacing. An ablative laser takes off the outer layer of skin and heats the underlying skin or dermis to stimulate the growth of new collagen. This leads to smoother, tighter skin as it heals. A non-ablative laser also stimulates collagen by warming the dermal layers without the peeling that comes from removing the outer layer of skin. This type of laser therapy lessens the recovery time, but the results are more subtle. Today, both methods are commonly delivered with fractional laser, which leaves microscopic columns of untreated tissue throughout the treatment area. Fractional lasers were developed to shorten recovery time and reduce the risk of side effects. Laser resurfacing helps to manage fine lines and mild skin discoloration, but is less effective for deep wrinkles. With your input, the professional can control how deep to set the laser and which areas of the skin to treat or avoid. It can take about a week for your skin to heal after a laser session. You may need repeated treatments to get the desired results. Then there's a chemical peel. With a chemical peel, a chemical solution is applied to remove the outer layer of skin. Just as with laser resurfacing, the skin tightens and smooths as it heals. However, peels are less precise than laser resurfacing. Peels can be a little more unpredictable depending on the thickness of the skin and where the skin is being treated. Depending on the wrinkles to treat, the dermatology professional might recommend different peel depths. For a medium or deep peel, you might need a sedative or pain medication. Immediately after your peel, your skin will be red, tight, and irritated. Deeper peels will take about a week to heal, with lighter peels requiring less recovery time. Good results may require more than one treatment or maintenance peels every few months. Then there's dermabrasion. Dermabrasion uses sand-like particles to remove the outer layer of skin. This decreases the appearance of fine lines since the skin that grows back is smoother. Microdermabrasion uses even finer particles and can be used to remove scars, age spots, and tattoos. Dermabrasion can be combined with other cosmetic procedures. Like with the other procedures, it can take the skin about a week to heal, but you don't necessarily need multiple treatments. Then there's neuromodulator injection, NEURO MODULATOR. A neuromodulator substance interferes with nerve function and can be injected at targeted nerves in specific sites. Neuromodulators used for wrinkles are classified as cosmetic injectables. They're delivered with a thin needle into the skin. Botulinum toxin, with brand names like Botox, Dysport, and Xeomin, is a neuromodulator that's approved for medical use to relax muscles. When the muscles relax, the skin on top appears smoother. These injections are often used between the eyebrows, across the forehead, and at the corners of the eyes. They can reduce the appearance of frown lines and other facial wrinkles for 3 to 4 months at a time. The placement of the injection must be precise. It's rare but possible for the neuromodulator to reach unintended nerves and muscle groups, affecting the movement and appearance of facial features. Other risks include allergic reactions, muscle weakness, vision problems, and difficulty talking, swallowing, or breathing. Next is fillers. Fillers are a type of injectable usually made of hyaluronic acid, like Restylane or Juvederm. The filler plumps the tissues, which smooths out wrinkles or softens the hills and valleys of the face, making deep lines less obvious. The fillers gradually absorb into the skin. Fillers can last for 6 months to a year, depending on the specific filler and where it's placed, Dr. Tolematt says. In a culture driven by keeping a grip on youth and vitality, fine lines and wrinkles may be an unwelcome arrival, but many people learn to accept and even embrace the signs of aging. If you're bothered by those aging signs, science can provide relatively safe ways to keep them at bay. Regular tweakments, T-W-E-A-K-M-E-N-T-S, as Dr. Bruce calls them, are one way to take care of your appearance so you can feel like yourself when you look in the mirror. Now, here's a short attached article in the Mayo Clinic Health Letter that's called How to Treat a Nosebleed. Most everyone experiences an occasional nosebleed. It can be scary, but usually it's a minor annoyance. Common nosebleed causes can include change of season, dryness, scratching, certain medications, and injuries. People on blood thinners may have worse nosebleeds than do others. Most nosebleeds stop on their own or stop after a few self-care steps. Sit upright and lean forward. By remaining upright, you reduce the pressure in the veins of your nose. This discourages further bleeding. Leaning forward will help you avoid swallowing blood. Pinch your nose. Use your thumb and index finger to pinch both nostrils shut, even if only one side is bleeding. Breathe through your mouth. Continue to pinch for 5 to 10 minutes. The pinching puts pressure on the bleeding point and often stops the flow of blood. Repeat these steps if it doesn't work. After the bleeding stops, don't pick or blow your nose. Try not to bend down for several hours. Keep your head higher than the level of your heart. Some nosebleeds require professional care. Seek medical attention if the bleeding is severe, lasts longer than 30 minutes, or interferes with your breathing. Have a nosebleed checked out right away if it follows an injury, like a fall or a car accident. Talk to your healthcare team if you're having nosebleeds more than once a week, even if you can stop them fairly easily. Determining the cause and avoiding risk factors or adjusting medication may make nosebleeds less likely. Now I'm going to read a short article from Second Opinion. My husband and I saw these UV wand cleaning devices. Are they a good idea for germ freaks like us? No. Although ultraviolet light devices are sometimes used in hospitals to sanitize against certain infectious organisms like C. difficile and methicillin-resistant staphylococcus called MRSA, they're strongly discouraged for in-home use. In fact, the FDA put out a warning about 8 common at-home UV wand sanitizing products, citing very high levels of light that can damage skin and eyes. The wands use UVC radiation, a type of UV light. This type of light effectively disinfects surfaces that may harbor many infectious microorganisms, including coronaviruses like the ones that cause COVID-19. However, the needed strength of UVC light has serious risks. In its warning, the FDA said that the products marketed to disinfect in seconds generally contain unsafe levels of UVC light. In tests, FDA researchers found that from 2 inches away, the devices emit about 3,000 times the amount of UVC known to be safe for humans. Exposure to excessive levels of UVC light has been linked to skin burns and discoloration, as well as photokeratitis, a burn in the cornea and conjunctiva of the eye. Photokeratitis can feel like your eyes are being rubbed in sand. It also occurs as snow blindness when due to unfiltered light exposure in extremely bright, snowy landscapes. Both the skin and eye effects can occur after just seconds of UVC light exposure. Leave the use of UVC devices to professionals. You're safer using traditional methods of germ cleaning, like regular washing with soap or detergent, combined with consistent air circulation. Very briefly, they talk about a blood test that's now available to the public to check for Alzheimer's. And they point out that these tests are not approved by the Food and Drug Administration. If you're concerned about Alzheimer's disease, discuss this with your healthcare team. Your team is equipped with experience and expertise to provide a more accurate and thorough assessment. The direct-to-consumer test uses only one measure of potential Alzheimer's risk, amyloid beta levels in the blood. This alone is not sufficient for diagnosing Alzheimer's disease or predicting Alzheimer's disease risk. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.